This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. 45 years ago this summer, the nation was starting to learn about a break-in at Democratic National Committee headquarters at the Watergate Hotel in Washington, D.C. It was called a third-rate burglary, but a little more than 2 years later, Richard Nixon resigned the presidency. One of the key figures in the so-called Watergate scandal was Elliot Richardson. Tom Vance now works for the Kalamazoo Community Foundation. He first met Elliot Richardson as a student journalist from Western Michigan University in 1976. Vance is the author of Elliot Richardson, The Virtue of Politics. It was originally published in 2000. Thank you for being here, Tom.
Thanks for having me, Gordon.
So first of all, let's go back and talk about how you developed such an interest. And I think if someone reads this book, it's fair to say an admiration for Elliot Richardson.
Right. A clear admiration. And I try to be objective. But I'm certainly a fan of his public service. So when I was at Western, All the President's Men came out in 76 when I was on the Western Herald. And all of us saw that movie many times. And Elliot Richardson was not a central figure in the movie, but it was clear that he was one of the heroes of a very traumatic political event. So he was in Benton Harbor that fall campaigning for Republican candidates. And Conrad Sutter, who was also on the Western Herald with me, we went and covered Elliot Richardson, and we met him. And I had just bought his book, and I was too chicken to take his book in to have Richardson sign it. But fortunately, Conrad had brought it in from the car without me knowing it. And he went up to Richardson and said, "Would you sign this for my friend?" So I had his copy of The Creative Balance, which was published in 76 when Richardson was the Commerce Secretary. And that sort of became my little repository of Elliot Richardson information over the years. So fast forward to in the early 1980s when my wife and I were in Germany when I was in the Army, I reread The Creative Balance and I wrote Richardson a letter. I don't know if he ever got it, but I sent it to him through the publisher. And I told him how much I admired his career. And I said, "I'm waiting for someone to write a biography of you. And if that doesn't happen, I'll have to do it myself," which was a pretty bold thing for a lieutenant in Germany that's just, you know, early in his career. So, and I kept that letter. So then fast forward to, I'm in a graduate writing class here at Western. Brad Hayden, an amazing writer that was busy here at Western teaching people how to write even better. We were in this class, and he asked everybody what you would do if you didn't have to work for a living, like, you know, if you won the lottery and you could do anything you wanted to. And I said I'd like to write a biography of Elliot Richardson. And I guess my enthusiasm came through so much that Professor Hayden and everyone in the class said, like, "Oh, Tom, you need to do that somehow. You need to figure out a way to write a biography of Richardson." And, of course, I was working full-time at the Upjohn Company then, and I didn't have the time it took to do real serious research like the Library of Congress and everything. So I decided to write a book for children, you know, for young adults.
Yeah.
And I figured I could do that and it could serve as an example of the next generation for politics. So I started doing that and I got to meet Richardson the next summer in Washington and had an hour-long interview with him. And this goes a long way of saying what kind of person he was. I submitted 20 questions ahead of time. And when we sat down, he said, "Okay, you've got 20 questions here. Which three do you want to talk about?" And we had an hour. So I panicked and had to pick the three most central questions. And each one was answered by a 15-minute long answer. So I kept working on it. And by 2000, I had a 35,000-word biography that the Council for Excellence in Government accepted and they put online. And Richardson saw a draft of it in December, and he died on New Year's Eve 1999. So he saw it and he approved. He blessed it. I wanted his approval on it. So again, it wasn't totally objective when you show the subject matter, the draft. And then I went on and did some a master's at Western here, and a lot of my master's classes, I was studying U.S. history with an emphasis in biography. And I spent several classes studying Richardson's mentors, and he was mentored by some of America's most brilliant legal minds, Judge Learned Hand and Justice Felix Frankfurter. And then he cut his political teeth through his uncle, Uncle Henry Shattuck, and then Senator Leverett Saltonstall. Those were his mentors, and those four people made him the person he was. And so I worked on that for a couple of years, and that was published in a journal, a Massachusetts historical journal. And then meanwhile, Don Carr, who's a Washington attorney, who had spent almost 15 years writing the first biography of Richardson, unfortunately, he died before his book was published, and it's still not published. But the last conversation I had with Don Carr was, we need to get my little online book out as a print-on-demand, basically a self-published book, just so something's out there on Richardson until your book comes out, because he was afraid it would take a while to come out, and his untimely death has hampered that. And it's
does it still seem like it might get out?
I don't think so. Sadly enough, I don't think so.
I want to go back a little bit before we get into Richardson's involvement in Watergate and what ultimately happened there. But he held a number of posts in the Nixon administration. Is there anyone that you would compare him to in terms of, you know, I mean, he served in foreign policy, domestic policy. Is there anyone else in history that really compares to him in terms of various types and degrees of service and in all of those posts being very well received?
Not quite. There are a handful of Americans who have served multiple presidential administrations in different jobs. He was 36 when he was Assistant Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, which doesn't exist anymore, under Eisenhower. But and then he went on to earn two historical records. He was the first person to ever be a U.S. attorney, which is the U.S. attorney for a state, and then attorney general for his state, which was Massachusetts, and then U.S. attorney general. No one has ever had those three jobs before. And he was the first person to hold four federal cabinet posts as Secretary of HEW, Secretary of Defense, Attorney General, and then Secretary of Commerce. And the only recent person who's done something close to that is George Shultz, who served in four cabinet-level positions under President Reagan. But one of them was not a cabinet level. It was a position when he was head of Office of Management and Budget that was a cabinet level designation, but he wasn't head of a federal cabinet department. So he's the only one that comes close to Richardson's record.
So when he became attorney general, was it largely seen as somebody who had a very sterling reputation in Washington and someone who people trusted?
He did. And he was so when Nixon was brand new president, Richardson became his deputy secretary of state, the number two person at the State Department. And he did that. And then he was elevated to the head of health, education, and welfare, his first real cabinet position. And then when Nixon reorganized his administration, he wanted Richardson as the defense secretary. And Richardson didn't really want that. He was happy. It's interesting, with Richardson's background, he was never very ambitious. He wanted to do great things, but he wasn't willing to do things necessary to do the great things. He just wanted to be tapped for his knowledge. He just wanted to serve. So he was happy.
When you say do the things necessary, you're sort of the political behind the scenes things of, to power plays and that sort of thing. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. When he clerked for Justice Felix Frankfurter, Frankfurter gave him some career advice that he always adhered to. And that was enjoy the job you're doing at the time for the sake of that job. And if you're always looking to position yourself for the next couple jobs in the future, then you're not really enjoying or focusing on your current job. And Richardson took that to heart. So he didn't really want to become Secretary of Defense. He was happy at HEW, but he went ahead and took that position. And then after 3 months as Secretary of Defense, President Nixon wanted him to become Attorney General. Watergate was starting to percolate at that point. And Richardson actually said no several times. And finally, Nixon insisted, and Richardson said, well, you know, I have to serve the president. He was very loyal, and he was a loyal team player. So the only way he took the job as attorney general, he sat down with the president, and he had to make sure the president was innocent of any wrongdoing. And President Nixon assured Richardson that that he had known nothing about Watergate. And he said, you pursue this wherever it goes, protect the presidency, don't protect the president or the administration. So Richardson was convinced that Nixon was innocent, and he took the job. And this is something that doesn't come through in a lot of the Watergate coverage that your listeners are hearing now. Watergate wasn't going to be the biggest problem at this point. He was brand new attorney general. And then he learns early into his job, the U.S. attorney from Maryland contacts him and says, we've got a problem with the vice president, Spiro Agnew.
Who had been governor of Maryland.
Had been governor of Maryland. And the U.S. attorney for Maryland had discovered that as governor of Maryland, Spiro Agnew was possibly involved with kickbacks, bribes, and tax evasion. And then they found out that it actually continued when he became vice president. So here Richardson is brand new attorney general. It's he's figuring out he's got to, and as things developed over the summer of 1973, when it became obvious that President Nixon probably would not survive as president, Richardson had to get Agnew to resign so he could be replaced by a new vice president so there'd be someone in charge when Nixon might be forced out of office. This was Richardson's summer of 1973. And he actually pulled that off, and he averted a huge constitutional crisis. He was able to convince Agnew to resign, and Gerald Ford, was appointed. He was the minority House leader. He was appointed as vice president under the 25th Amendment, which had never been used before. And it was only because Richardson personally represented the federal case in a federal court that Agnew didn't go to prison. The federal judge said, Agnew admitted to, pleaded guilty to one count, which was enough to just, get him out of the vice presidency. And the federal judge said, if it wasn't for your testimony, Attorney General Richardson, Agnew would be going to jail. But Richardson knew that would serve no purpose to have a vice president go to prison at that point. They needed to get him out of there so Ford could become vice president.
But actually, at the time that Richard Nixon is drawing up this list of people who could become vice president, one of the names on this list is Elliot Richardson.
Right.
That really, and Elliot Richardson was the one who recognized that can't work while he's attorney general who is carrying out his duties related to Spiro Agnew.
Right. So Richardson insisted that his name come off since he had orchestrated Agnew's departure.
How did Elliot Richardson come to know Archibald Cox? And people who are deep into the Watergate history know that those two names will always be synonymous and linked together, but linked to the Watergate story.
Right. Archie Cox was Richardson's law professor at Harvard, and they hadn't been friends, but he'd never really lost track of Archibald Cox. And actually, Archie Cox had given Richardson some career advice also when Richardson was climbing up the ladder. And actually, as you can imagine, there weren't a long list of people who wanted to become special prosecutor. Richardson had a hard time finding reputable people who would do that. So Archie Cox was not his first choice, but he was a good choice. And he'd been Solicitor General. He was a Democrat. And that's something that President Nixon didn't really approve of the selection of Archie Cox. But throughout the summer, Richardson and Cox worked together. Cox would be trying to investigate the Watergate crisis. The White House would constantly push back. Richardson would get calls from Alexander Haig, who was Nixon's chief of staff, or from Nixon himself, and say, tell Cox to back off. And Richardson, when Richardson went in front of his Senate confirmation hearings to be attorney general, the Senate made Richardson promise that he would appoint a special prosecutor and that only Richardson could fire the special prosecutor, and that could only be for extraordinary improprieties. And so Richardson had that commitment to the Senate. So as the summer progressed, it became obvious that Richardson was probably not going to survive in his job if he was going to be honor his promise to the Senate. And it really frustrated him because he appreciated everything that Nixon had done for him, for his career. Nixon had put him in all these cabinet positions. And finally, things came to a head on October 20th, where the president wanted Cox fired, and Richardson met with him several times with the president and with Cox. He just wasn't able to fix it, and so he resigned. And then the president ordered William Ruckelshaus, who was the number two at Justice, the deputy attorney general. Ruckelshaus resigned too. And then it fell to Bork, Robert Bork, who was the number three person at the Justice Department. And this is something that people don't hear too much about. There's a nuance to this that's important for your listeners. Bork agreed to fire Cox because he thought the president had a right to do that, and he had not promised anything to the Senate because he hadn't been confirmed by the Senate. But Bork said to Richardson and Ruckelshaus, I think at some point someone's got to follow the president's order and fire Cox, so I'll do that, but then I'll resign. So Bork was going to resign, and Richardson and Ruckelshaus said, no, you can't resign. Someone has to stay and mind the store. And that was a real high road approach that everyone in the Justice Department can't resign. So, and Bork really paid a heavy price for that, because then later when he came up for a Supreme Court nomination, he didn't get the Supreme Court nomination because he had fired. And Richardson actually appeared in front of the Senate during that hearing and supported Bork.
And this is what is known as the Saturday Night Massacre.
Right.
When we had three attorneys general in the United States on the same day, two people refusing to fire the special prosecutor. Is it fair to say that that is one of the major turning points in Watergate, where we move from the idea of a third-rate burglary to this is obstruction of justice, these are the sort of things that merit impeachment and the discussion of impeachment in Congress of a sitting president?
It really did turn the tide with the public. When Elliot resigned, 3 million telegrams, this was back when people sent telegrams before people could tweet or send emails, 3 million telegrams were sent to Washington, D.C. in support of Richardson and Ruckelshaus and in support of Archie Cox. So I think it was, and even Republican leaders then, Richardson had so much credibility. He didn't like labels, but he considered himself a moderate. But he was seen as a key figure in the liberal wing of the Republican Party, which you don't even hear about anymore, which is an oxymoron now, right? Or it's a paradox. But so he had so much credibility that by him resigning, that really... that was the firestorm that started the whole series of, it was apparent that the House was going to vote for impeachment and that the Senate would go along with the impeachment. And so Nixon resigned.
In your book, there's several different points where Elliot Richardson's name got mentioned as a potential candidate for president himself. Did you ever get a sense from him? Did he ever seriously consider that? Did he ever seriously consider doing? And again, that requires a lot of those things you talked about, the political stuff, if you're going to launch a campaign. Did he ever seriously consider it?
He did. And of course, with his resume and from what we know of his character, he would have been, I think, an amazing president. But again, it was after he resigned, he was out of office for a year and he toured the country and gave hundreds of speeches. And at that point, if Gerald Ford wasn't going to run for his own term, then Richardson said he would run for president, but that he would not run against Ford if Ford declared for running for his own term. And Richardson would do interviews on Meet the Press and other media outlets, and he would always say, I would like to be president or vice president or secretary of the state, but what I might do about that is another story. Because again, he just wanted to be called to service, and wasn't willing to do the kind of things that, we consider politics sometimes a tainted profession. Elliot Richardson actually said that politics is the most difficult of the arts and the noblest of professions. He considered himself a politician and he embraced politics, which is the reason I subtitled my book, The Virtue of Politics. When the Council for Excellence in Government brought that out as an online book in 2000, they wanted to call it The Virtue of Public Service. And I said, no, there's no clever message there. I mean, of course, public service is virtuous, but politics is what people need to know can be virtuous. And that was one of the gifts that I think Richardson gave to the American people when he resigned on October 20th, 1973.
He certainly believed that politics was an instrument to do good. But at the same time, I would think there's a lot of people who watched Watergate blow up and who would, you know, hear that someone with Elliot Richardson's resume experience, et cetera, wasn't willing to do the political things. I mean, from what you're saying, I guess, you know, like raising money and that sort of thing would have been a hurdle that he would have had to go past if he was going to run. And I suppose there's a lot of people who think there isn't a whole lot of virtue in politics if the events of Watergate can transpire that way. And if someone with Elliot Richardson's background and everything else decides that they can't run for the highest office in the land.
Well, first of all, he saw himself as a person that solved problems and could get to the nature of an issue, and he really thought that he failed with Watergate. He thought he should have been able to figure out a way to keep the White House happy, to keep the special prosecutor happy. So it's ironic that he saw his actions as a failure. And then we also need to talk about how when President Ford pardoned Nixon. Now, that probably derailed Ford's chances for winning. It was a very close election when Ford and Carter ran.
Right.
And if Ford had not pardoned Nixon, I think he would have won. And then Elliot would have continued on in Ford's cabinet and maybe would have been Ford's Secretary of State, possibly, if Kissinger had decided to retire.
Different career trajectory.
Right. But something that that Richardson kicks himself for, that he did this didn't come out until 1997, just a couple years before his death, when he was doing an oral history project. And he mentioned how there was another – everyone – I think Ford's pardoning of Nixon was the right thing to do because, like Ford said, we're spending way too much time on this Watergate thing. People don't really want Nixon to go to prison anyway, and that would be the result probably of if we carried the investigation through the end. So Ford did that for good reasons, and I think that was most people, well, maybe most people didn't agree because Ford wasn't reelected. But Richardson thought later, and he was working on this, and he was going to mention to Ford, there's a term in the legal area called a prosecutor's discretion. And prosecutors don't prosecute everybody who's guilty of something. So Richardson was working on this plan of under Ford, the prosecution of Nixon could have continued through its natural course, and they could have laid out all these charges against former President Nixon. And then instead of pardoning him, they would say, it appears you're guilty of all these things here, and you're not going to be prosecuted because you've already resigned, and that's enough. But that way, there'd be closure, which the nation wanted. There'd be closure without a pardon. And a couple days before Richardson was going to see Ford and present this plan, Ford pardoned Nixon. So Richardson kicked himself for that, and that was...
And he didn't get to Ford sooner,
right,
and lay out
so
his
he
ideas.
Takes great responsibility, which speaks a lot to his ethics, that he failed during Watergate and he failed through the pardon. I mean, it's just really something. And you tie that together with his whole life, and I just think it's a great story. And for people who are cynical about politics, I would say read about Elliot Richardson and maybe it'll inspire you to change your mind.
So let's now draw some parallels cautiously between Elliot Richardson and the Watergate investigation in present day. And I say cautiously because it is dangerous to start talking about things that could result in the removal of the president from office when at this point there is simply an investigation and charges have not been leveled. But there are a couple of interesting things to note here. One of them, of course, being that the FBI director was fired by President Trump, and that at least some people in the Trump administration have floated the idea that Special Counsel Robert Mueller, who has been on the job a relatively short period of time, could be removed. When you see that and you think of Elliot Richardson, what comes to your mind?
Well, there are a lot of perils. Perils too.
Maybe,
actually,
yeah.
The Nixon White House was exhibiting a lot of paranoia, and the Nixon White House thought it was us and them. And when Richardson first joined the Nixon administration, in his first conversation with President Nixon, he said, "You've won by a huge margin, and there is no they. Everybody in the country, even people who voted against you, want you to succeed." And Nixon never really understood that, and there could be some parallels with the current administration that feels it's under siege. The press, Nixon was always attacking the press, as did Vice President Agnew. And of course, we know the press were the good guys with Watergate, with Woodward and Bernstein, and the greatest American reporting ever with that. And with Watergate, things were happening so fast over that summer, it was hard for people to keep up with all that. And I think we're experiencing the same kind of fatigue now with, by the time this airs, who knows what the status will be of the special prosecutor or of the president and his key team. There was something, though, that Richardson said after Watergate when he would talk about it. And again, your listeners need to know, he never badmouthed President Nixon. He never spoke ill of him at all. And Richardson said, you know, the system worked. For as traumatic as Watergate was to the American public, the system worked. And it wasn't pleasant, but it worked. The three branches of government, the balances of power, in the end, they all worked. And the only thing I can say to speculate for this current situation is I think our system is built to handle whatever we throw at it. And hopefully our balance of power will make everything settle.
Does the system, though, in order to work properly, need an Elliot Richardson, or maybe a couple of Elliot Richardsons in there who are willing to blow the whistle, if that's what's required, are people who will put, to use a phrase that gets used often these days, country over party.
Right. That's a good point. I think people do need to be able to focus on individuals. When Acting Attorney General Sally Yates was fired, people, she thought she was doing what she thought was right, and there were some parallels then in that reporting about Richardson. And of course, with Comey, people are seeing Comey as an individual that's you know, stood up for what he believed. And actually, I sent Director Comey a copy of the Virtue of Politics. I don't know if he's read it. I'm waiting for there to be an interview with him when someone says, "What's on your reading stand in your bedroom?" And he would, but no. So I don't know if he's been a pretty busy guy. I'm guessing he hasn't had a chance to read this, but I'm assuming he was a fan of Elliot Richardson. His career has shown a lot of bravery in different situations like that. But I think you're right. I think people don't identify with complex problems like with Watergate. The way I got involved with my fascination started with Woodward and Bernstein at the Washington Post and All the President's Men movie. And that was a tangible way to get my hands around it. And then I was attracted to the example of Elliot Richardson. So I think a lot of people now are paying attention to people as the players in this drama.
Tom Vance's book, Elliot Richardson, The Virtue of Politics, was originally published in 2000. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Gordon.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.